FM. And now it's time for Rush On. You should be able to switch on. Oh. Yeah.
I don't know if you
had gone. Oh, no. I just... Ack. There you go. You want this?
Yeah.
There we go.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, March 15th, 2026, and this is episode 28 of The Rift. As it has been for the overwhelming majority of my lifetime, the United States is once again at war. On February 28th, the U.S. and Israel launched joint missile strikes targeting multiple sites across Iran, killing Iran's supreme leader Ali Khamenei, several other high-ranking Iranian officials, and reportedly over 600 Iranian civilians. Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon have killed over 30 people while displacing hundreds of thousands, while retaliatory airstrikes by Iran have killed around a dozen Israelis. Just like the Iraq War over two decades ago, the United States seems to be justifying its involvement through a series of, frankly, obvious lies, largely centered around eliminating Iran's nuclear weapons program. Never mind that there's no evidence that such a nuclear weapons program even exists. For those of us that grew up hearing the administration of then-President George W. Bush spin lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, this all seems depressingly familiar. This time around, though, one of the primary drivers of the conflict seems to be Israel's desire to expand its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians to other neighboring states, a goal that the United States government has been quite happy to assist with. Legacy American news media, fulfilling its time-honored purpose of justifying our unprovoked foreign wars, has been emphasizing the repressive nature of the Iranian government, and, to be sure, the Iranian people have experienced atrocities at the hands of their government for years, including the government killings of thousands of protesters in January of this year. Though, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Western nations' culpability in that political instability and repression as well, stemming all the way back to the CIA and MI6-backed overthrow of Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. But as the civilian death toll in Iran continues to climb upward, it should be eminently clear that American bombs will not liberate the Iranian people. That is something that Iranians themselves have been working toward on multiple fronts, despite incredibly hostile conditions imposed by their own government and foreign entities alike. Rather than provide endless commentary on the obviously unwarranted and illegal U.S.-Israeli aggression in Iran, for today's show, I wanted to better understand what people's movements in Iran, and in particular the environmental movement, have been experiencing over the years of political instability, and how the war is affecting them today. As residents of one of the world's most important oil-producing nations, Iranian environmental activists must contend with issues of water scarcity, air quality, and the environmental harms of oil extraction, all while navigating a brutally repressive regime. To learn more about what they're up against and how they're responding, I spoke with Dr. Maziar Sami, associate researcher at the Center for Global Political Economy at the University of Sussex. Maziar is a political economist, a scholar of Iran's environmental movement, and an environmentalist himself. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about the struggles Iranian environmental activists are waging, how they're navigating their own repressive government and the incursions of foreign aggressors like the US and Israel, and what Iran needs to build its own ecologically and socially just future. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you by Make It Champaign Urbana. Make It Champaign Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community through the Champaign Welcome Crew. Are you passionate about the community? As an ambassador, you can help make a difference to new residents by answering their questions and sharing your community experiences. Ready to join over 50 ambassadors making a difference? For more information, visit makeitcu.com. Support for WEFT is also made possible in part by the Champaign Park District and Blues, Soul, and Rock and Roller Robert Cray in concert, Tuesday, March 31st at the Virginia Theater. Tickets for the All Amped Up Tour 2026 are now available at thevirginia.org. And now, here's my conversation with Dr. Maziar Sami. I'm joined now by Maziar Sami, associate researcher at the Center for Global Political Economy at the University of Sussex. Maziar, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for your invitation.
So just to kind of get us started, would you mind just describing the thrust of your research and your general area of work?
My research is in the field of political economy. I did my PhD project on political economy of the Eurozone crisis after the 2008 global financial crash. And I have also worked on political economy in the context of Iran, my home country, and the Middle East, with some focus on the environmental issues.
Yeah, and how did the environmental movement in Iran come to be an area of focus of yours?
When I was a teenager, I was a volunteer in Green Front of Iran, which was maybe the first environmental NGO in Iran in the 90s. And environmentalism has been a passion of mine since a young age. And after progressing in my studies, I also paid some attention on it in academic terms.
Great. So just to kind of give people an overview, I imagine, you know, a lot of the people listening here in central Illinois are probably not very familiar with what environmental activists in Iran have been doing. What would you say are some of the more major fights and struggles that environmental activists in Iran have been waging, you know, over the years?
You could say all the four elements constitute environmental struggles in Iran. Water, has been a key issue. Lake Urmia, Caron River, they have been for two decades sources of environmental grievance. And water scarcity, access to water, it has been an increasing source of environmental grievances. And we have had multiple water protests in Iran over the past few years. Land, another element, has been a source of environmental grievances, both in terms of land grabbing and the state and parastatal corporations' attempts for deforestation, turning forests and mountains into urban or semi in grazing trees to build villas, these sort of practices. Those have been sources of tension. And also there's a major issue of land subsidence, which is related to the water problem because of the deep water extractions. There is a major problem of land subsidence. Then we have the problem of air. Air pollution has been a source of grievance, and there have been many protests over air quality. Some of it is just the usual pollution that you get in urban areas, but some of it is also dust storms that are related to draining the swamps in oil-rich areas, which in turn cause these dust storms. And then the last element, fire, energy has been a source of problems. Iran experiences major power cuts in summer and gas shortages in winter, even though the country, as you know, is very rich in fossil fuels. So these are some of the major problems. There are also that environmentalists in Iran have been mobilizing around, and also grassroots spontaneous movements have mobilized around. But also there are conservation attempts and activism around biodiversity. And all these different struggles, they have faced severe crackdown from the state. And we can maybe discuss that further.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of the next thing that I was going to ask about, especially being that obviously, over the last several decades, there's been a fair amount of political instability in Iran. So you've been dealing with different governments, right? And has there been a difference in the level of repression, or the methods, or you know, what you've had to deal with over the years?
So, in the 90s in Iran, there were multiple, maybe even hundreds of environmental NGOs. They were formed in the 90s. The country was going through this phase of reconstruction after the war with Iraq. There was some limited political liberalization. And formally, there were many NGOs that were allowed to function. And these NGOs, they knew the limits of permissible action, so they wouldn't they wouldn't commit to risky behavior that would bring them under the security apparatus's radar. They would just focus on conservation attempts that or on raising awareness campaigns that didn't clash with the government. But over the years, both the environmental catastrophes worsened and led to harsher grievances from the people, but also the government's response became harsher and more securitized. So as a result, we see environmental activism that is directly anti-governmental. In 2021, there was this major protest over water shortages in Khuzestan, the oil-rich province in southern Iran, that led to other provinces joining the protests, and it was came to be known as the Uprising of the Thirsty. And the slogans that people chanted during that uprising were directly anti-government. And there were, and some protesters were killed by the government at that time. And another sign of the escalation of these environmental tensions is that in 2018, the intelligence ministry arrested some environmentalists and charged them with espionage. Many of them had to endure years of imprisonment. And Kavuzzeh Demami, who was a university professor and one of these environmentalists, he died in suspicious circumstances in his cell. So this shows how the pattern of activism shifted, both from how society sought to express its grievances, but also how the government responded to these grievances.
Yeah, so I think there's a few different things that I'd want to talk about. And I think the first is, you know, you mentioned these, the uprising of the thirsty, these protests rooted in very material kind of populist demands. It made me curious about the extent to which, environmental activists and the NGOs and like the environmental movement broadly in Iran is connected or has tensions with the more sort of like working class and populist segments of the, you know, what you might consider the organized left, and how that has kind of influenced some of these movements.
So the organized left was wiped out in 1980s in Iran, with mass executions and sending everyone to exile. But there are leftist elements in environmental activism in Iran. I don't think there is a uniform pattern in how different peoples in Iran interact with the NGOs, and I say peoples because of the multi-ethnic nature of Iran. We have different peoples with different national imaginaries, and those national imaginaries relate to nature in different ways. So in Kurdistan, the environmental NGOs they are tightly connected with the wider, the broader public, Kurdish public. And when there are fires in forests in Kurdistan, and other Kurdistan is a province and there are other Kurdish towns and cities, when there are fires in Kurdish areas, environmental NGOs like CHIA, they mobilize people to go volunteer and contain the fire. And in some cases, they believe that the government intentionally doesn't intervene when there are environmental disasters in their areas. And when some of the volunteers have been killed in the fire, they have been given a martyr's funeral, a martyr's farewell. But you wouldn't see the same pattern like in Tehran, where the population is, it doesn't have that the same sense of community that you see in Kurdistan. It doesn't have the same relation with nature as in Kurdistan. It's a metropole, it's a massive city, and it's more difficult to have this cross-class alliances. It doesn't mean that necessarily like working class is against those who describe themselves as environmental activists, but the relation is not as easy.
Yeah, and I mean that does sound like it mirrors the role of environmental organizations in a lot of places, which is that like it's very much determined by the sort of local political landscape and community and sentiment. I think the other thing that your earlier answer made me think about, you know, you talked about droughts in some of the oil producing sections of Iran. Obviously, you know, as you mentioned, Iran is a very important oil producing country. And I imagine that there's something of a dilemma that a lot of these countries face. You know, I've seen it in a lot of the Latin American oil producing countries. We saw it with, you know, the Pink Tide and their sort of struggle over like what to do around resource sovereignty. And so I'm curious, because, you know, that oil is also the source of much of the foreign intervention that has been imposed upon Iran, be it, you know, the British and the Americans who overthrew Mossadegh back in 1953 for control over oil, you know, all the way to, you know, present day aggression, which is not necessarily related directly to natural resources, but figures into the equation. I'm curious, A, you know, whether there is sort of a conflict between the more sort of arguments in favor of resource sovereignty and, you know, we need to control our oil and you know, build up our people versus environmentalists who may not, who may be more concerned about the environmental and health effects of oil and the people affected by extraction. And then also whether some of these foreign interventions have also kind of shaped or affected the activism that occurs around that.
Many tend to approach oil as many tend to approach oil in a deterministic way, and kind of argue that because Iran and Saudi Arabia and these other places, because they have oil, they are cursed with this resource and they are doomed to produce these rentier states with authoritarianism, and comes with it militarism, etc. Related to this, there is also this dilemma of security problems that come with environmental issues, which we have a lot of them in the Middle East. And like you remember, there were discussions of how Syrian civil war was caused by drought. But US has oil, Norway has oil, UK has oil, Brazil is a resource-rich country, and none of them deterministically are cursed to become authoritarian. So what happens is that in these places, some ready models are used to create the stereotypes of Middle Eastern despotism, and kind of argue that there is this dead end. But it's the other way around. It's the politics that decides. It's the political struggles that decide how the oil will be used or not used. Of course, the presence of oil factors in those political struggles, but it's not the only factor. And in the context of Iran itself, oil at least twice was a factor for democratic mobilization. The movement for nationalization of oil in 1950s, it was a major grassroots democratic struggle. It wasn't an elitist project. Mossadegh was an elite figure, but he had popular backing. One of the key episodes of the 1979 revolution in Iran was the strike of oil workers. And although that revolution turned out to bring an authoritarian government, an authoritarian regime, it had democratic aspirations. The democratic aspirations were present. One of the main slogans was Azadi, freedom. And to mobilize the strike for oil industry, you had to do massive organizing. And the workers' councils that were formed on the eve of the revolution, they were a major democratic force. They were crushed later on, but they existed. So what I'm trying to say is that the simple fact of oil being there, it doesn't determine despotism or authoritarianism. One issue is that places like Iran are still hostage to an idea of development that the time of which has passed. And because of that, the tension that you said between the resource sovereignty and environmentalism, that seems to be unresolved. So I don't think it's the issue of oil that causes the problem. It's the development model that is hegemonic. And it's not only for the regime. It's that pursues the model. This disorganized opposition also has the same developmental developmentalist imaginary. And that developmentalist imaginary prevents resolving this tension between resource sovereignty and environmentalism.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's something that you kind of see really the world over. And this is what you've kind of written about, and you had a chapter in this book, Enforcing Ecocide, that's largely about this exact thing, you know, kind of thinking beyond this resource curse sort of truism. And it just makes me think of yeah, everywhere else that I've heard this exact thing, be it, you know, the Peruvian Amazon where they're drilling for oil, or, you know, Colombia, or, you know, and almost any oil-rich nation, you're going to be encountering this sort of development model, right, that has been really popularized through some of these multilateral international institutions. You know, privatization, structural adjustment, the whole nine yards, right? So, you know, with that in mind, what do you think we need to think about, just, you know, kind of beyond that, right? What does an actual sustainable, you know, heavy air quotes development model look like for a place like Iran?
So it would be difficult to say now without mentioning the war that Israel and the U.S. have waged on Iran, of the unprovoked act of aggression. But that war hasn't happened in a vacuum. And Netanyahu and Trump are not the only guys who were thinking of a war with Iran.
Oh, it feels like it's been the dream of every U.S. politician for I don't know how long, unfortunately.
Yes, Iran has been a potential target of every U.S. president, but every U.S. president was also set to be a potential target of Iran by the Iranian state itself. In the 80s, in the schools, we would chant, "Persian Gulf is very, very Reagan." The one chant that everyone used to hear from Iran before recent protests was "Marg bar Amerika," death to the U.S. And the military buildup from now, the Revolutionary Guard has been successful in attacking U.S. assets across the Middle East and attacking Israel, and they have not failed so far, like after nearly 2 weeks. And this is not the first time, because they were prepared. But did they need to prepare for this war? Didn't they contribute to this war? Couldn't they take trajectories to de-escalate and not get stuck in a war? I'm not talking about their position with Trump, whose politics is hard to grasp, but this tension between Iran and Israel, and Iran and the U.S., the militarized approach of the Islamic Republic has been one factor in creating this tension. After this long pretext, one thing is to demilitarize. So much, the state is spending so much on these drones that are not useless. Now they are being shot at US targets, but they're not achieving anything for the ordinary Iranians. And they're not also liberating Palestine. So that would be like the first step of a different path for Iran, that is a state that is not heavily militarized and securitized, and it does not see its own population as a potential enemy. Remind you, the official death toll of the massacre that they did in the protests of in January protests, in only 2 days, 8th and 9th of January, they killed over 3,000 people. This is the official death toll. They say it was Mossad agents, and no one believes it, because why Mossad agents are not killing the Revolutionary Guard? Why would they kill the ordinary protesters? And we know that this 3,000 figure, it is less than the actual figure, for sure. And this is still less than the victims of US-Israeli aggression in the current war. So imagine the brutality of the state against its own citizen. So that would be the first step. What comes after that? Iranians need to reimagine Iran differently. Iranian nationalism, pretty much, it's not exceptional in the macho nature of it. It's racist, it's authoritarian, and it prevents the Iranian peoples from being on equal footing with each other. And it, as a result, it takes hostage the nature, the different parts of Iran. It takes them hostage to the vision of a central state that wants to project its own image of what's good for the people and the nature over a massive country with 90 million people. Some guys in Tehran want to decide things for everyone. And that has to change. And that is not something that is unique to, that is not something that is exclusively the problem of the current regime. That cuts across the political spectrum.
Yeah, I, you know, thinking about the first part of your answer, I think the world over, certainly in Iran, environmental activists specifically are targeted by government forces, by police, by military, and the force with which Iran does target its own population is brutal. At the same time, I wonder if you know, some people might say, well, how do we demilitarize when we have all these external threats, right? When the U.S. is kind of doing whatever, when Israel's constantly at our door. I don't know that I have a good answer for this. How do you balance kind of demilitarization and not turning that against your own people with being able to stay relatively secure in an area where, there are malevolent actors like the United States you know, the death to America, they're chanting that for a reason.
Yes, so definitely foreign imperialism and domestic authoritarianism, they, although there are oppositional forces, but they work as a nexus. They create a self-reinforcing ecosystem, a self-reproducing ecosystem. And of course, when the missiles fly, environmentalism becomes a luxury. Of course, when people don't have access to electricity or fuel because of bombardment, then speaking of decarbonization becomes ridiculous. And the urgency that war produces conceals the long-term trends of degradation and environmental catastrophes. This is true. So it's not only the Ayatollah was to be blamed. Of course, the foreign and especially the US role is catastrophic. But the Iranian state also has navigated these issues with quite extraordinary talent for trouble. Like, Turkey is not exactly a puppet regime for the US. It's a NATO member, but it's not falling in line with whatever Washington dictates. And it pushes back against Israel, it pushes back against the US, it pushes back against Russia, it balances it balances these foreign powers in a more complex way than what the Iranian government, what the Islamic Republic used to do.
Yeah, I guess just to, you know, as we get close to time here and close to wrapping things up, I wonder just in terms of like immediately what you kind of want to see in such a horrible situation, you know, especially being that the war itself is introducing new environmental catastrophes. You're seeing reports of oil facilities being bombed in Tehran, and, you know, there's toxic smoke and rain, which is surely going to have repercussions for so many people. What do you hope to see in just the immediate future?
Well, in the immediate future, I hope the war ends and there won't be another round of conflict. I could try hard to find some hope even during this war. As you know, with the bombardment of the oil depots in Tehran, the day after, it rained oil in the city. And all the buildings, people's cars, everything. Spring is coming and the blossoms, leaves, everything was drenched in oil. And I saw that some vets, they have volunteered to clean stray cats and dogs. There are many cats and street cats in Tehran. And they formed these little volunteer groups to clean oil off the cats. And there are attempts for people to send money to families and friends. So fragile networks of mutual aid. It's not enough, but it shows that the society is trying to reclaim life within the ruins, even though it's stuck between a tyrannical regime and external murderous regimes. And if the war ends, the confrontation of the state and the society is not going to be resolved. And society still has room to fight. Just before Trump and Netanyahu started this war, we were seeing another round of protests in Iran, despite the brutal crackdown of the previous round of protests in January. So this is a society that is yearning for freedom. And I don't think people are yet ready to give up. There were elements of delusional hope for external help. And you might see that in the US there are these monarchists who dream of returning the son of the Shah.
They're finding it very easy to get on the news these days.
Yes. The conclusion of this war will prove their delusions to be delusions. The conclusion of this war will prove their plans to be delusional. And that would open space for a different kind of politics. And I hope that we can fight for a radical democracy in Iran, one that is able to reimagine the relation between the state and the people, but also different peoples amongst themselves, and reimagine the place of Iran in the world.
Well, that is certainly worth hoping for. But for now, Maziar Sami, associate researcher at the Center for Global Political Economy at the University of Sussex, really appreciate your time and sharing your expertise with me. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Dr. Maziar Sami, associate researcher at the Center for Global Political Economy at the University of Sussex. I want to thank him again for sharing his time and expertise with me, especially during such a chaotic and difficult time. I was most struck by what Maziar said about the relationship between the repression and militarized violence perpetrated by the Iranian government against its own people and the imperialist violence imposed upon Iran by actors like the United States and Israel, that even though these states are obviously in opposition to one another, both of these patterns of state violence reinforce each other. And it made me feel that, you know, we have essentially two responsibilities as activists here in the United States, the first of which is to keep building a real anti-war movement in this country, which unfortunately we don't have much of right now. Like any nation, Iran has its own questions of sustainability and ecological health and development that it needs to answer. And, I hope that at some point we will have a world centered around global cooperation in which those questions can be answered together. But it should be clear that American bombs raining down death and, as we spoke about, environmental catastrophe itself under the pretense of exporting freedom are not helping. And the second thing, of course, is that I hope we can all continue to learn from the people in those struggles in Iran to better understand what they're up against and to think hard about how our liberation is related to theirs and what knowledge we can take from them. That's it for today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators of your choosing if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, we've got some tunes up until the top of the hour, and then, as usual, it is On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be Sunday, April 5th. Until then, take care.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, along with our community partners, including Furniture Lounge, The Upper Bout, Josh Gallagher at Edward Jones Financial, and A to Z Painting and Decorating. Listener-supported, volunteer-run since 1981. Community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM, WEFT.
We are WEFT Champaign. 90.1 FM, your community radio station since 1981.
And go. Woo!